Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from Relator in Eli Lilly and Company versus Honorable John Marshall.
May it please the court, Mr. John Hill will present argument for Relators. Relators have reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The regulations of the Federal Drug Administration will be referred to by me frequently during this presentation. I have them with me and believe they're all on file with the court, require drug manufacturers such as Relator Lilly to compile and file with the FDA forms which report adverse events that are observed during the taking of a particular drug, in this case, Prozac, which is, the court well knows, is an antidepressant drug that's alleged to have caused the decedent suicide in this underlying real party and interest case. And Lilly is required to maintain these reports at its own company, in its own company files, as well as filing them with the FDA. It's all a part of a national reporting system, which is a part of a congressional mandate for the FDA to ensure safe and effective drugs in this country. And at issue here is whether the names and addresses of the healthcare professionals who observe and file these adverse event reports with Lilly and the FDA, whether those names and addresses can be discovered in civil litigation arising from the use of that drug by the filing of discovery requests for such names and addresses with the trial court.
Mr. Hill, I gather then from the original petition for mandamus that your client filed here in January and from your opening remarks and briefs that really the overriding issue here is whether that FDA policy that you've just referenced preempts, and it's a preemption question that overrides in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if there is preemption, there's been a clear abuse of discretion by Judge Marshall.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if there is not preemption, then Eli Lilly loses in this proceeding.
No, Your Honor, I would not agree to that, and I will flesh that out as I go along.
Okay.
At issue here, the substance of the reports, these adverse events reports, is not at issue. That has already been provided to the plaintiffs by Lilly. And as some of the exhibits will show that you have on file, the circumstances involving the adverse events have been given plaintiffs in considerable detail. But Lilly is requesting this honorable court to direct the trial court to enter a protective order ordering that the names and addresses of the health care professionals making these reports not be discovered and to issue your writ of mandamus only if the trial court refuses to follow that direction. Now, here's the reason for our request. It's our position that this is necessary to maintain the viability of a national voluntary reporting system that's established by the FDA regulations pursuant to congressional mandate to ensure that we have safe and effective drugs to be sold and administered in the United States in the public health interest. If Judge Marshall's order stands and the word goes out that this promise of confidentiality, which is a part of that national reporting system and an integral part of it, can be overridden in civil litigation by the filing of a discovery request on the manufacturer, this national reporting system will be substantially destroyed according to the undisputed proof that is in this record. Now, I want to refer...
Mr. Hill, would you walk us through the procedural posture of this case? I believe there's an allegation that you waived the privilege by failing to assert it.
There's no waiver in this case, Your Honor. That exposes the weakness of the respondent's position, and I will address waiver. But according to the FDA statement of interest that's on file here, a very powerful statement, the FDA determined years ago the confidentiality of the identity of the health care providers was necessary for the spontaneous reporting system to function. The FDA commissioner stated, on the basis of long-standing FDA experience, that without such a pledge of confidentiality, quote, the possibility of persuading health professionals voluntarily to submit important adverse reaction information on drugs to the Food and Drug Administration is substantially diminished and indeed perhaps wholly destroyed. And that statement is also set out in the Federal Register.
Okay, in that regard, Mr. Hill, that statement in the involvement of the FDA in this case was procured by Eli Lilly, was it not?
I got a call, Judge Doggett, from, I believe it was Lorraine, I can't think of her last name right now, but I'll certainly give it to the court if it's of any interest, asking, knowing that this matter was pending here, asking what she could do to get the concerns of the FDA before the court, and I told her just to write a letter, which she did, and it was filed. Now, the FDA then, at the invitation of this court, was asked to file its concerns with the trial court, which it did.
And I'm familiar with that, of course, since that was an order of this court. But are you saying that Eli Lilly did not procure the involvement of the FDA in this proceeding, had no...
I'm not aware that you would put it in those terms. I'm not aware of any contact by Eli Lilly. I was contacted by this individual that said she was aware that this case was pending on mandamus, application writ for mandamus to this court, and that they were very concerned about these reports, these names and addresses being revealed, and wanted to know how she could make that known to you. I have her name written down somewhere in my Austin office if you'd care to have it in the record.
As far as the claim of preemption on the FDA regulations, is the only form of preemption that we're dealing with here the public policy that underlies the FDA?
No, it's the preemption authorities here, what I think would be primarily led by the De La Cesta case, which is an implied preemption that if the order stands as an obstacle to the carrying out of a federal policy, the objectives of a federal policy, preemption applies. And I will discuss those.
Let me ask you, if you would, to discuss now Section 20.83 of those regulations and why that rule that specifically authorizes disclosure of FDA records by court order doesn't destroy your case.
Well, Your Honor, 20.83 is a simple statement that if the FDA is taken into court normally under a Freedom of Information Act in order to release something that by their regulation is deemed confidential, and the court concludes, I don't know if this has ever happened, but it's what the regulation allows to happen, that if the court orders them to release that information otherwise made confidential, that they will, of course, obey the law. That has nothing to do with this case. The regulations are still in place requiring confidentiality. They're still there for the purpose of fostering this very valuable and vital national program. They still must be respected. FDA is not a party to this case, and there's no final order against them. It's totally irrelevant.
In essence, 20.83 doesn't apply to Eli Lilly. It only applies to the FDA.
Well, it applies, Your Honor, as it is written. It applies to the FDA where requests are made to the FDA.
And from
here you're faced with an order against Eli Lilly, which is preempted by the federal program and the confidentiality that's provided by those federal regulations to foster that program.
And
it's a different, totally different analogy and a totally different situation.
None of those regulations apply specifically to Eli Lilly. They apply to the Food and Drug Administration, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. They apply as they're written, Judge Doggett, and they're clearly, it's clear how they are written, and I have stated clearly how they are written.
As written, they apply to the FDA. They do not apply to the drug manufacturer.
They're not written to apply to the drug manufacturers. A plain reading of them will reveal that, and it's a misstatement by counsel for a petitioner to try to invoke that provision.
If it were so important to protect the secrecy of information supplied to the drug manufacturer, why doesn't the regulation cover the manufacturer specifically?
Your Honor, that's a simple statement in the regulation simply saying we've got exemptions in here for certain documents. But if it's an FOAI request and a final court judgment that says, nonetheless, you must produce those, the FDA is not above the law. They have to obey the law. It has nothing to do with the issues that are before this court.
Judge Hill, haven't we seen a similar situation involving psychiatry? When psychiatrists realized that they might have to divulge their records, they stopped keeping written records or destroyed whatever they had.
Well, many courts, you know, without confidentiality, this program will be destroyed. We have evidence all over this record to that effect. If you want to destroy it, you just uphold Judge Marshall's court order. No other court that's heard Prozac cases has allowed the discovery of the names. None. There's a MDL where most of these cases are pending in Indiana, where Judge Dillon has said that they can be masked and will be masked. Every case, the case in Harris County, the same result. Case in Kentucky, the same result. Four cases, same result. Absolutely no difference. The Federal Drug Administration intervening here and saying, please, all these courts have let this program stay in effect. Don't let one judge, for whatever arbitrary reason, decide that he's going to march to a different drummer and we're going to march to a different drummer and we're going to have to do this whether we want to or not. He stands utterly alone and without any precedent. And those are the hard facts of what we're facing here. So why won't he take the MDL like everybody else has done?
Mr. Hill, I'm not clear whether Eli Lilly is seeking to protect its own interests in any way or whether it's merely asserting the FDA's interests as set out in this regulation.
Absolutely. This has nothing in the world to do with any interest that Eli Lilly is trying to promote for its own benefit.
Well, let me be clear. The interest I'm referring to, a property interest or any sort of proprietary information or anything of that nature. Is there any property interest or any interest?
There are some issues in the other mandamus that deal with that. That's on its way through Dallas and involves 76A and may or may not end up here. There are some other issues of that type. But as far as this particular case is concerned, you could argue, if one wanted to, that it might be in the best interest of Eli Lilly if they were interested in withholding anything to run all these health care professionals out of the system so that they won't be inclined to want to do these sort of reporting, and that we won't have these arguments about these. This is in the interest of the national program, because if you don't monitor these drugs while they're in the field and while they're being used, how do you keep up with trying to see whether they need to be changed, whether they need to have some additional warnings put out, whether they need to be withdrawn from the market? These are policies for all of us, for the national interest, not for the interest of the drug manufacturer.
Why is Eli Lilly going to the considerable expense of protecting an FDA regulation? And the national interest, however admirable that might be, why is that in Eli Lilly's specific interest to do so?
I can't speak for management, of course. I'm just a lawyer working on this phase of the case, but I applaud them for doing it. I think they're doing a good service for all of us trying to uphold this national reporting system. They are required, Your Honor, by law, by federal law, to file these reports and to file them not only in their company records, but to file them with the FDA. They're required to do that. They believe this is a good program. It's good for the development of drugs. It helps them as far as the clinical trials and clinical tests are concerned. And it also helps all of us by having a method whereby we can ensure the best information available to us to decide whether these drugs are truly safe and effective or not.
Judge, is there anyone who disputes that it's in the best interest of the nation to have these doctors voluntarily make these reports?
I don't see how you can, you know, we've got affidavits all over this record. No, the answer to your question is no, I'm not aware of any. We have here, and I don't dispute anyone's private needs and private agenda, but you have, if you're going to balance the interest here, you have on the one hand, the only statement that was ever made by the plaintiff as to why they wanted these doctors' names was made by my good friend, a distinguished professor from SMU, in this late brief that he filed. And he said in there that he needed these because it would tell us the plaintiffs need the name to determine if the physicians are in a particular specialty, in a particular locale, or have had more than one experience similar to what they have reported. Now that is very weak, Your Honor, when balanced against the viability of this important, vital, national reporting system.
Is there any penalty that Eli Lilly would incur for violating this regulation by voluntarily disclosing this or even disclosing it under a court order?
Yes, we'd be violating federal law. The federal law says that these are confidential, and we're caught on the horns of a dilemma. Here is the court saying give them up, and here's federal law saying don't give them up.
I thought I covered that with you earlier, and maybe I misunderstood. Which federal law would Eli Lilly violate if it complied with
the law that requires these reports to be kept confidential? The names, not the reports, the names and addresses of the reporters
to be kept
confidential. That is the federal law. It is in a regulation that has the same dignity as law, for preemptive purposes, as a statute or even the Constitution.
And which I thought I understood you to tell me earlier does not apply to Eli Lilly. It only applies to the FDA.
The confidentiality, as pointed out by the statement that's in here from the FDA, the commissioner concludes such important, he concludes that the deletion of such information from such reports prior to release is fully within the intent and personal privacy and confidential commercial information exemption. And he points out that whether they are given up by Eli Lilly or given up by the FDA, it still guts the federal reporting system. It still flies in the face of the objectives, and therefore you don't preempt simply because the literal regulations preempt. You preempt if, in order to foster the objectives of the federal program, you should preempt the court order that stands as an obstacle in its face. The mere fact that Eli Lilly is the one that's being asked, if you allow that to circumvent the federal law, then it would be an easy matter to do it in any case.
So the bottom line is we're back to the public policy underlying the FDA regulatory scheme, and you cannot point to any specific regulation by section and number that applies to Eli Lilly and prohibits it complying with this?
Absolutely. Every regulation that we have pointed out in our brief and in the regulations apply to Eli Lilly in the sense that I'm talking about. They may not say the drug manufacturer, after all, this is a regulation of the FDA. It says in the regulations that Eli Lilly must file these reports with FDA, and then it says the names and reporters, in order to encourage the system, will remain undisclosed.
If the whole system applies, then why doesn't the regulation 20.83 permitting disclosure pursuant to court order apply to Eli Lilly?
No, now, Your Honor, I didn't say that. I said that in the sense of a preemption argument, that if you have a situation where the federal regulation mandates confidentiality on the part of the FDA, it's just as applicable to the report, the same report that they acquired from the manufacturer while it's sitting there in the hands of the manufacturer for preemption purposes. That's not the same as to say that 20.83, which clearly applies to a court order, would also apply to Eli Lilly. There are different circumstances and there are different regulations.
Since I've asked you so many questions, I know I got you away from Judge Gonzalez's, and I was really eager to hear the answer to the waiver argument, since the position
Eli Lilly. Here's what happened.
First mandamus seems to be different than the second mandamus.
Here's what happened. We had the October 17th discovery order entered, in which Judge Marshall said that the reporters' names, the patient's name would be not discoverable, but the reporter's name would. At that time, Your Honor, there were no, without any exception, every court that had heard this had placed in effect an order which did just the opposite. Negotiations began between Mr. Smith and Mr. Smith, Mr. Wade Smith from our side and Mr. Paul Smith from their side, in which, in good faith, Wade Smith believed that that issue was going to go away and that Mr. Smith would accept what everybody else had accepted. In the meantime, it became necessary to file mandamus one because the time was running out in terms of the trade secret. So that was filed, still believing in good faith that the reporter issue was going to go away. Then when Mr. Smith surprised everybody and went back to court and said, no, it's not going to go away, we're going not only to get it, but we're going to sanction you for it, we went back to Judge Marshall and said, look, to clear the air, number one, let us explain what's happened. And Judge Marshall stated on the record, it will be taken as absolutely true what you're saying. You don't have to even take the stand to testify. I'll take it as true. I'm going to reorder. And he reordered in the January order. I'm going to reorder you to produce it without these names, with the names in there. And then I'm going to sanction you so much money for the man going up there. We then brought this mandamus. There is no waiver. We're asking that both of those orders be set aside. The mandamus was filed within 90 days of the original order. There's absolutely no basis for a waiver.
Mr. Hill, I certainly did not want to piecemeal this case and hear this mandamus now and the 76 issues later on. It was my understanding, perhaps just my own and not the court's, that all of these issues were here this morning for a resolution and argument.
No, Your Honor, 76A applies to dissemination issues that's under C of 166B5.
I understand that, but for the purpose of economy of time, I thought that all these issues were before the court. If
76A could reach the issue of discoverability, I think it would be very good. If the court wants to make that change in the rules, you might be making a good step forward. But right now, discoverability is under A, and it's not under C, which where 76A springs
in. I'm very well aware of that, Mr. Hill. I'm just talking about the economy of time and having dual arguments and having one decision here and then later on coming back for another argument with regards to 76A.
If you want to send this back and say to those people that are going to first hear 76A at Dallas, you're authorized also to hear this as a part of it. That doesn't bother me personally at all, but we can't do it the way the rule is written right now because discoverability matters have to come here straight on mandamus.
Counsel, can you briefly address the approach?
Where am I going with my time? I might as well just take it all now. I see kind of how it's going to all go, so let's just get it.
We will give you some rebuttal time. Sister court in Tennessee has had a similar case where I understand they drew a balance and allowed the doctors who voluntarily would give their names to be released.
The 12 out of 400. Are you referring to the Newsom case?
Yes, I'm referring to Newsom.
They split the baby. They gave them 12 out of 400. I think they missed the balance. But that's what they did. And bear in mind, they didn't give much thought to preemption in the Newsom case. They did. You know, you've got all kinds of results, Your Honor, in terms of one is consistent except for Newsom, which gave them 12 out of 400. Everything else, nothing. Except they will say, like Dillon said in his order, but if the plaintiff comes back with a specific proof of some specified relevancy, that he can't get any other way, and there are disputed facts, he can come back and repetition for that particular inquiry. And, you know, you can always, I'm not suggesting you do that. I think it's a pure preemption case, and that's enough to decide the case.
If you add that,
can be done.
Some of the other federal reporting schemes, to see if any of those have a direct prohibition on the private reporter against disclosing the information.
Your Honor, I haven't checked that.
And do you also know if other federal reporting schemes have an analogous provision to 20.83? Common boilerplate in federal regulations, or is it rather unique to this program?
With the court's indulgence, I'll certainly check that and advise the court. I don't know the answer to it right today.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the sponsor.
Okay, please, the court.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Bill Borsanio, and I represent Jackie Lynn Biffle and her two daughters. As the court well knows, this is a mandamus proceeding directed at least at the initial stage, the trial court's sanctions order dated January 14 of 1992. This is a bit of a messy case because actually we're talking in terms of the sequence of events about three separate hearings and three separate orders. In their moving papers, first supplement, Lilly also challenges the October 23rd discovery order as being void and unconstitutional, something that was not done until even after the January 14 sanctions order. And the last bit of information that was presented to the trial judge in connection with a motion for reconsideration involves a hearing on March 3rd, which culminated in an order of March 5th. So with respect to the procedural posture of this case, it's a complicated matter, and I'll get back to that on the question of abuse of discretion. Because this is a mandamus case, in order to prevail, Lilly must convince this court, under familiar standards most recently articulated in Walker versus Packer, that the trial judge abused his discretion in ordering discovery and in imposing sanctions, and perhaps, if they're wanting to go this far at this stage of the game, in overruling the motion for reconsideration. Lilly must also show that Lilly's remedies at law are inadequate under standards set by the court in Walker versus Packer. The standards in Walker versus Packer with respect to the adequacy of the legal remedy and with respect to the abuse of discretion point are particularly pertinent here. The court explains in Walker that when we're talking about a factual issue as distinguished from a legal question, a legal claim of privilege, the trial judge has a substantial amount of discretion, and the trial judge is not to be second-guessed by a reviewing court, which is not permitted to substitute its judgment for the trial court. If there was a legal question, a legal claim of privilege, a viable legal claim of would be otherwise, if the trial judge was wrong, assuming that the matter had been presented in the proper way to the trial judge, then there would be an abuse of discretion. Lilly's argument in this case rests upon, as their papers indicate, the linchpin of their argument is that there is an absolute federal privilege created by certain federal regulations that is unyielding and not subject to a court order of a Texas trial judge or some other court order of a federal judge or even an order of this court. The argument that I will make on that is a textual argument, not a vague argument. I'd like to get back to that in a minute. But with respect to that argument, if Lilly fails in that argument, they should lose this mandamus proceeding because the trial judge will not have abused his discretion, have essentially three reasons for saying why the trial judge wouldn't have abused his discretion at any stage. First, he has discretion in factual matters involving questions of protection and harm. Second,
Mr. Sanio, did your client dispute the affidavits of Lilly that they're divulging the names of the reporters would eviscerate the voluntary adverse reaction reporting system? Was that disputed in this record?
Well, Your Honor, we have to go to the three hearings and to talk about what happened. In the very first discovery order, there was no claim of preemption or privilege asserted by Lilly. Lilly asserted entitlement to a protective order on prudential grounds, citing the regulations that we're talking about here, but no claim of absolute federal privilege or preemption was argued.
In the responses they filed to the plaintiff's first discovery request that bears the clerk's file mark of September 16, 1991, they did state, make a claim of confidentiality under
yes.
FDA law?
They make a claim of confidentiality, a claim that they are entitled under balancing principles to protection. They supported that claim in the record by one affidavit of a PhD by the name of Talbot. That affidavit is about a variety of matters, but in one paragraph, paragraph 18, there might be some other reference to a regulation in another paragraph, the affidavit says, this all needs to be kept top secret, absolutely secret, as a matter of protection because the entire system will be destroyed and medical research will come to an end. A conclusory statement without support other than the regulations and the affidavit itself that I submit would not measure up to the requirements of Garcia versus Peoples, which requires something more than a mere conclusion, something more than a broad allegation of harm, but an articulated showing of a real injury.
Arthur, you may be referring to the same or a different affidavit, but I recall reading of affidavits that also said that were the names of the reporters divulged, that understandably plaintiffs in lawsuits involving Prozac want to depose those physicians who made those reports, and perhaps they wouldn't voluntarily report because they would not want to get involved in other civil litigation. Isn't that part of the record?
That paragraph 18 makes that general claim or states that general fear. Now, with respect to the sanctions hearing, the trial judge ordered disclosure of the pertinent records, form 1169s in part, said that they could be redacted to shield some manufacturing information, some formulas, and the names of patients, but not the names of the reporters.
Counsel,
not the names of the reporters.
Excuse me, Professor Garcinio.
Yes,
is it your client's position that it would not have a chilling effect if the names of the physicians were released?
Your Honor, our position is that the showing made by Lilly amounts to a fear of a chilling effect that needs under our law and appropriate principles to be balanced against our need for this basic information. Basic in the sense that we're talking about the identity of persons having knowledge of relevant facts, which this court has said in Giffen versus Smith, and which the last unnumbered paragraph of 166B subparagraph 3 indicates should never be shielded from disclosure and discovery.
Isn't the results of Tennessee where out of 400 doctors, only 12 agreed to come forward, isn't that proof that 97% of the physicians would in effect stop sending in their reports or not volunteer?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. It's difficult to know how the Tennessee Supreme Court came up with the number 12. They came up with a number 12, and it's questionable as to how many you're starting with as a base number, whether it's 350 or 400 or some lesser number of doctors. But the Supreme Court of Tennessee basically says you get 12, and you can talk to them, but you can't disclose their identity to third parties. That's the consent part, unless they consent. There's nothing in that Tennessee order that says that you would stop there. If that wasn't a proper balance, as it turned out in terms of the information that you got. The Tennessee opinion is important, in my judgment, because it makes it plain that there is no preemption privilege argument. There is merely a protective order balancing argument. That court, under its law, under its discovery principles, struck the balance in favor of some disclosure. The Tennessee opinion indicates that the lawyers on both sides didn't do a very good job in addressing the balancing matters. So as an initial matter, we get 12 with a protection for those 12 if they want it from further disclosure.
But here there is no protection.
Well, Your Honor, the claim that was made by Lilly at the initial order, at the initial hearing that led to the initial order, was that the only protection, it's the same argument they're making here, that they put in privilege form, that the only protection that they're after is absolute protection, that's the most that they can get is the absolute lower level of what's involved. They make an argument that confidentiality and disclosure are notions of that are incompatible. That's, I respectfully submit, a silly argument. Confidentiality can yield to disclosure if disclosure is limited. It's a balancing process that involves the rights of both litigants, not simply one side.
You may be right, but here it's all one what. The trial judge in this case has ordered non-protected disclosure.
They asked for that. They made that argument that they're entitled to a protective order on the basis of that one affidavit, that the world will come to an end if we don't get complete protection. That's the argument they made. The trial judge didn't buy it. They didn't do what they were ordered to do, and the trial judge imposed sanctions on them. At the second hearing, they said that we didn't do what you ordered us. We thought we were going to be able to make some sort of an agreement with you after counsel had gone to Indianapolis and gotten documents that were essentially useless. The judge doesn't believe that, and he sanctions them. Then they come to this court. They come to this court a second time saying that order is inappropriate, even though the first time they were here, they said they had no claim of privilege that they were asserting. And if the court would like me to direct the court to specific pages of their paperwork in the prior mandamus, on pages 9 and 29 of their original petition for mandamus, they say they have no claim. They have no claim of privilege. All they're seeking is protection from dissemination.
Now, coming back, though, to the substantive point, as opposed to the procedural issues that have been raised, if this would have a chilling effect, if it were established, satisfactory, mm-hmm. that this work was likely to, which is sort of a meteorological issue as opposed to a factual issue, have a chilling effect on this system, do you agree that it would be appropriate to produce the documents only under some sort of protection?
Yes. We wholeheartedly agree with that.
But that what does it do to your case to not have, if the writ's granted in this case, what does that do to your case not to have the names of the reporters?
Here's what it does.
In this instance, if you say it's a balancing test, there's no absolute privilege, tell us about the what's in your favor, why you have a compelling need.
They obtained FDA approval to market this drug by submitting a lot of information to the FDA, including adverse reaction reports that predated approval. Subsequent to approval, a much larger number of adverse reaction reports have been prepared by reporters and sent to the FDA and Lilly. I believe somewhere in the neighborhood of 16,000 to 17,000 of them. Those reports, Form 1169s, are, I think of them as leads because they're brief descriptions of some adverse reaction to the subject drug of Prozac. They're made by the persons who are in the best position to provide further information about experience in the field, the physicians who were involved in treating patients who had adverse reactions. These people are not only people with knowledge of relevant facts, they are the best people with the most pertinent knowledge about the relevant facts. Facts relevant to the question of defect and unreasonable danger, and relevant to causation. Does this drug cause people to commit suicide like Mr. Biffle committed suicide? Does this drug cause homicide? Is it unreasonably dangerous as marketed?
because of the way it's marketed. Does Lilly, on the basis of what it knows now, have a difficult time with claims about its bona fides and what it knew and what it should have known before?
Surely
if we
have
this,
expert
we can work on this.
Surely you have an expert witness who will testify to each of those elements.
Yes,
of
we have, expert witnesses.
And you've been provided. Lilly agrees that your client is entitled to the substantive portions of the adverse reaction reports, with merely the names of the patient and the physician redacted. How does that harm your ability to make a case?
Justice Cornyn, the reports are very abbreviated. There's a good deal more redacted, actually, than we've been talking about. And the trial judge knew that. Without the ability to follow up that the FDA in its affidavit says is so important, and that Lilly says is so important, we don't have the ability to get our case ready.
Well,
we have one hand tied behind our back while they have information which they're doing something with, they're doing nothing with. And we at least ought to be able to show, if it's true, that they're doing nothing, that they're not engaging in any follow-up, that it's just being warehoused for some purpose.
And is it your position that your prospects of success on the merits of your case, that the probability of succeeding there will be substantially reduced if you do not get this information?
We will be out of balance, Your Honor. We'll have a more difficult time. Our experts will have a harder time saying that their opinions are based on complete information, because it won't be complete information. It will be a much different form of information than Lilly's experts. And we'll be impaired, and I expect we'll find that our proof is objectionable on that basis.
With regard specifically to the impact of Section 20.83,
yes, Your Honor.
I understand from Mr. Hill's argument that it's really irrelevant because it doesn't apply to Eli Lilly and only to FDA.
Well, you can't have it both ways, Your Honor. The regulations that he is talking about, first of all, they all lead back to Part 20. They're all subject to Part 20. And 2083 is in Part 20 as a limitation on the exemption. And it's there. It does apply to Lilly, but all the other regulations that authorize and require the FDA to shield are regulations that are pertinent to the FDA. In for a penny, in for a pound. Take it all or take none of it.
Counsel, has your client attempted to make a request under the Freedom of Information Act, or is that avenue be foreclosed by the
That avenue would not be foreclosed. We do not believe that avenue is the only avenue that's available to a party in civil litigation who wants to obtain information from another party.
But you have not tried to get this information from the FDA?
No.
You could not get
it. Oh. I can't really speak to that on the basis of my knowledge. I'd have to confer with counsel. I can supplement on that.
Mr. Arsenio, what impact will our decision here in this case have on the other mandamus of 76A? Can you give us both scenarios? Will it be moot in one sense if we agree with the position of the relator?
I'm not altogether sure, Your Honor. I don't think that 76A goes away regardless. I think that maybe the most important issue here is what is done with the identity of some or all of the reporters if this court concludes that there was not an abuse of discretion. And as I indicated, we would not be adverse to entering into an anti-dissemination agreement that was an appropriate one. Either the trial judge's discretion, this court's discretion, or whatever. This case is piecemeal. There are prior proceedings, this proceeding, probably proceedings to come.
How many times are we going to hear before we resolve these issues, these two issues on these mandamus? Lilly 1 and Lilly 2.
I don't know.
We all resolve it in this case.
You're not aware of any requirement that one bring all their, seek all claims to mandamus in a single proceeding, are you? There's no impediment to somebody filing
a number of different mandamus actions. It's in the discretion of the court whether to hear it or not.
No, Your Honor, but there is a requirement of abuse of discretion, and I don't believe a trial judge can be fairly accused of accusing his discretion when he fails to sustain a privilege claim when it wasn't made, or when proof in support of, even when the proof in support of a protective order comes at the third hearing after, and we would, of course, if I had more time, dispute the proof at every stage of the proceeding.
At what point did the trial judge receive any direct input from the federal government? Is that prior to the third hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. Some substantial period of time after this court's order.
What's your position with regard to the FDA's petition before the trial?
Well, the FDA statement speaks for itself. It looks like a legal brief. It does equivocate on whether there's a privilege or just some policy-based entitlement to protection. And the attorney appearing for the FDA says that he was appearing for the FDA and not appearing for Lilly, but he indicated that his appearance there would primarily benefit, or maybe not primarily, would necessarily benefit Lilly.
If Judge Marshall's order stands, doesn't this have implications for all drugs for which that FDA approves? In other words, the reporters of adverse reactions, not just for Prozac, but for every other drug approved by the FDA, isn't that implicated here too?
I think that there is a broader implication than just this case, Your Honor, but we have to be thinking about claims of a product defect or negligent marketing and causation, where the claimant seeks to establish his entitlement to relief on the basis of the experiences of people after the drug is put in use in the field. The very same thing, I'll stop now, the very same thing that the FDA representative's affidavit says that they want this information for.
You said there were three reasons why the trial judge could not abuse his discretion if there was no absolute privilege, and you only named one of them directly.
Well, I think that there is.
Carried it off elsewhere. Could you just, for the sake of my notes, I've left a little gap there, and I think we've covered them, but could you restate?
I think, first of all, under Walker versus Packer, Mr. Chief Justice, that there is discretion in factual matters, and I think this is, if not a meteorological matter, it's a factual matter as distinguished from a legal claim of privilege. Of course, I have to prevail on my argument that there is no absolute federal privilege in order to say that. But assuming no absolute federal privilege, then the trial judge's discretion based upon what was done in his court is the primary watchword.
That's the one you've already covered.
Second, the delay in proceedings and some inconsistency on the part of Lilly in the way they acted in both pleading and proving entitlement to any relief, when you measure it over the entire course of the proceedings, should be factored into whether the trial judge abused his discretion in making the original order and in imposing sanctions, and frankly, in failing to reconsider favorably on the basis of what was presented at the third hearing.
Factored in as waiver or factored in as
I don't think I need to call it waiver, Your Honor. I think that the trial judge is in a position of being challenged that he abused his discretion based upon what he did. I think what other people did and didn't do is very pertinent to that. I'm not going to say that there should be some strict absolute rule of waiver that this court should apply if in the case there's some showing of good cause or something like that. I don't believe that. But under these circumstances, in this case, no abuse of discretion. I think it would be unwise, policy-based, unwise to let this matter drag out over three hearings and two mandamuses and potentially more before we actually figure out what the other side's argument is.
And what's your third?
The third one is at every stage, there is a deficiency in proof of entitlement to protective order under Garcia versus Peoples.
If Judge Marshall had sustained Lilly's objection, under Walker versus Packard, would you have a viable mandamus claim? Is that too unfair a question?
Your Honor, I have to think about that one. I do think we would. I think in terms of the abuse of discretion, I'd have, you know, there's a lot of trial court discretion. I'd have trouble with that problem, but I wouldn't have a lot of trouble with the adequacy of the legal remedy, because our ability to prosecute our claim is impaired. Impaired if we don't get information from the best people who have knowledge of relevant facts and get a chance to make our case ready for trial. If we don't have what we need in order to give our experts an equal chance, then our abilities to present our claims are impaired.
Have the redacted versions of the ADRs been furnished to you at this point?
Well,
I see a nod. I guess let me ask this question, because I see a nodding of head from counsel. Are they a part of the record in this mandamus, any of those ADRs that would allow us to see the form of the ADR?
The adverse reaction reports?
Yes.
There are some forms, but
are there any of the specific reports so we can see what the public health statements are?
There's
attached
to the affidavit we filed, and they are part of the record.
There are some, but
not 17,000.
No, not very many. We didn't get very many.
Thank you.
Regarding the questions. Yes, regarding the protection, if there were a middle ground here and we were not talking about the documents redacted or the documents without redaction, if they were to be produced under some protective order, is it possible to afford adequate protection if it were justified? In this setting, when there are multiple cases pending around the country, and when, if it were a perfect world, if one plaintiff got the information, all of the plaintiffs should get the information, isn't the whatever confidentiality is involved essentially breached?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that an order could be fashioned that makes the information not available for public disclosure. It makes it available for a proper use by counsel having similar claims and a similar need for the information in their interests, in the interests of their clients, and in the public interest.
What if the protection included the prohibition against approaching any of the reporters without prior leave of court application?
I don't think we'd have difficulty with that, Ron.
But doesn't all of this slide us into the second, the second mandamus?
It does. It pours into it. It does. It leaks over into it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time was initially reserved?
About 8 minutes
of
initial
reserve. I think the number of questions we have
for
both sides
is
fair to extend that amount of time.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. First, as to the abuse of discretion point that Professor DeSanio raised, our brief shows that we take the position first that there was a clear error of law. That is, that the trial judge acted without authority and without legal authority in failing to recognize the federal law, which was in conflict with his order. Therefore, that order, both orders did that, because both orders ordered the production. They were both void in that respect. We also invoke an abuse of discretion section in our brief, in case the court conclude that that's the way you're going to write the opinion. We don't think that's the way to write it. We've indicated that in our brief. But if you go on abuse of discretion rather than clear error of law, then it's still our position that when the judge was faced with every other court that ever heard this matter disagreeing with him and stating that the disclosures should not be made of these names and that they should be redacted with all the substance of the report going to the plaintiff. And when he considered and gives no attention, and the record will show this, to the national reporting system as if it doesn't even exist or has no purpose. And when all of the affidavits that are before him, particularly on the reconsideration, which is before this court, when you ordered the FDA, didn't order, but suggested that the FDA could file their concerns, he has all of that before him, which clearly shows that, and it is here, and it is a powerful document, and I know this court is not going to just give short shrift to the position that's outlined there by the United States government that's in charge of food and drugs in this country, making a serious statement to this court about its concern. And it says there that the Supreme Court has explained, state law is nullified to the extent that it actually conflicts with federal law. Such a conflict arises when compliance with both federal and state regulation is a physical impossibility, or when state law stands as an obstacle to the accomplishment and execution of the full purposes and objectives of Congress. And they cite the De La Cesta case that I mentioned to Justice Doggett. Moreover, federal regulations, which are at least here, can have a great preemptive effect as federal statutes. And they go on to say that the regulations are preempted whether they are released by Eli Lilly or not, because they undermine the system. Now, that's all here. And that was before Judge Marshall. All we're asking you to do is to consider it. Anyone that doesn't consider that just simply discards it, I think, is abusing their discretion. There was no dispute about that matter. There's no dispute here about that matter.
At what point was this before Judge Marshall with regards to the reporters?
It was, you know, one of the surprising things that Professor DeSanio said in his brief, and I know it just that his lack of familiarity with what actually happened is his statement that we didn't present that matter early on. We objected to this 63 times in the request for documents. We specifically argued it and strenuously before Judge Marshall, all the way through. We've been in his face on this from the very beginning about this particular point. I don't know where he gets the idea that we some way didn't get up front. We had Dr. Talbot's affidavit before him. Dr. Talbot's affidavit is very, very strong on this point. It was before Judge Marshall at that time. It just blows my mind as to where Professor DeSanio has the notion that we in any way were late in getting this point before Judge Marshall. That's ridiculous. It's not true. It's false.
If I understand the argument that you're making about abuse of discretion, then, if instead of doing what he actually did, Judge Marshall had followed the course of the Tennessee Supreme Court and said, well, as you termed it, we'll split the baby. I'll give you a few now and see how it works, and maybe you can come back and look at more later if it's justified. That would have been an abuse of discretion under your argument also.
I think so. I think so, Your Honor, because there's an effort here now. I can see it developing to see whether or not there's some way that we can, quote, split the baby. If there's some way that we can take a dissemination order, if there's some way that maybe we can say, well, you give us a protective order and you come back later. If this rule, if we get the word out from this court, this authoritative body here, that there is a way, if you report into this federal system, which you've been doing, and these doctors have been great and cooperating, and remember, we're talking about the whole population out here. We're not just talking about one case. We're talking about everybody's benefit to have reports coming in. If there's something wrong with Prozac, let it come in. Let these reports come in. It's to everybody's advantage to have that that system work. Now, if the word goes out to the doctors, and it's undisputed in this record, that if the word goes out to them that, well, you can no longer rely on the confidentiality that pledged to you by federal law and pledged to you by Eli Lilly when they take those reports, doesn't mean one thing. You can be hassled, you can be harassed, you can be whatever. It makes doctors not want to engage in that kind of a program. And it's just that simple. Now, if the court feels that under the Dillon standard and some of these other orders that have come down, that having sustained our right to redact these under the federal law, that if the plaintiff shows a specific specified situation with relevance, we're not asking for this to be in the opinion. I'm saying that if you're asking for something that at least some other court has done, that has been done in some of the others. And we're not, our position is that preemption applies and that's the end of it. But if the court does anything, it should go no further than that.
Is it your position disclosed to Mr. Smith's client in this case under Rule 76A, if there are court records, and as much as they would have a probable adverse effect on the public health, safety, or health or safety, they'd be subject to disclosure to third parties who may seek to intervene in the provisions of Rule 76A, would they not?
Well, 76A, I know there's a certain amount of confusion among the bar today about 76A. We all know that, and you're going to have to hear that, and I don't know how all that will iron out, whether we'll be a part of it or not. We're one of several cases that are out there working their way up here on 76A. It's my perception that 76A is not involved here, that this is a discovery matter. And just like Judge D'Arsonio stated, he said if the judge had refused their request and had let us mask, that he would be up here on the mandamus because he would have to take the position that he didn't have an adequate remedy at law. The same thing applies to us. If we have to release the name, we violate the federal law, and we can't redeem ourselves later on by somebody saying on appeal that you were wrong about it. So this is a mandamus situation because it's a discoverability issue. 76A will come into play on all other issues, mainly their large, I don't want to foreclose that other proceeding. I hate to speak about another proceeding in this proceeding, but generically, let me say, it basically surrounds trade secret issues and issues of that type.
Under the law, you're asking us to announce today, then, if a manufacturer of breast implants has reports from hundreds of doctors that there's a serious health problem that they report, the manufacturer would be able to keep that confidential forever, the names of those doctors.
Well, Your Honor, you're asking me about another case, and I'm not sure what the regulations are about that, and I'm speaking about Prozac and these regulations this day in this court, and I'm not speaking to the breast transplant litigation. I would say that if there's a set of regulations that state that if you will report, if you will voluntarily report in to us what's happening out there in silicone breast transplants, and you'll cooperate with this program so we can know as much as we can in the public interest about what's going on in that area, we will give you confidentiality. And I think in that instance, you would have a replay of some of the issues that we are talking about here today. But I don't want to get bogged down in somebody else's litigation and lawsuit here today. Well, I think I've made that point, that we're talking here about the fact that if there had not been, and I want to just, since Mr. Joe Breeman is national...
I think you need to take a response.
Beg your pardon?
I
want you to have an opportunity for a full response, if that's responsive to my last
question. I think it is, that we want to point out that these reports are an early warning system. To the FDA and to Lilly or any drug manufacturer, that more work is needed in a particular area. That would be one point that I'd like to say is a relevant inquiry for this court in trying to balance the equities in this situation, balance the weight to be given to these factors. If the reports are not filed, no one would know what is happening in the present population as to drug experiences. I think that's a powerful, powerful public consideration. And we're here, we like to believe in the interest of the public health, not to damage the public health, but to protect the public health by allowing this program to remain viable, which has been in the works for many, many years, never been challenged like this. It's worked well for this country, and we don't think we ought to do something just for one private litigant that's contrary to every other court order that's ever touched it, and damage that very vital public program, which is in everyone's interest to know what's really happening out there in these drug experiences in the general population. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the arguments for this morning. Foregoing clauses are submitted on brief and oral arguments. The Marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.